Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce you to the music you'll be hearing at the festival this summer. This season, we've designed one of our richest and most enchanting musical journeys yet. Russian Reflections illuminates the great dialogue between Russia and the West, from which Russian classical music grew into one of the most beloved of all musical traditions. Russia's musical culture is as elusive as it is irresistible. The soul of Russian music is impossible to capture with words. It is utterly unique. No one could have invented such a confoundingly glorious tradition. Russia's music is the sui generis expression of her people's experiences. Yet at the same time, many of the elements that distinguish Russian music ultimately defy cultural boundaries: love and death, passion and pathos, struggle and triumph. This summer's seven concert programs bring together Russian and Western composers to magnify the universal resonance of Russia's musical culture. We'll hear the romantic pathos of Rachmaninoff and Shostakovich alongside Schumann, Fauré, and Dvorak. We'll encounter the sophisticated elegance of Tchaikovsky next to music by Mozart and Mendelssohn. We'll marvel at the impeccable craftsmanship of Prokofiev, Taneyev, and Johannes Brahms. Each of these juxtapositions will cast Russia's musical identity into sharp relief, while also revealing an essential character that transcends any cultural divide. Audio Notes are designed to enhance your enjoyment and deepen your appreciation of the music you'll be hearing at the festival. I'll be joined by Artistic Co-Director Wu Han, Audio Notes author and producer Patrick Castillo, and some of this season's festival artists to offer historical and cultural context and a variety of perspectives on this summer's concert programs. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you at the concerts.
As Russia marched towards revolution, her music was likewise headed for a radical change. The romantic spirit of Tchaikovsky, nowhere in greater evidence than in his magnificent Serenade for Strings, found its torchbearer a generation later in Sergei Rachmaninoff. Meanwhile, Rachmaninoff's boyhood schoolmate, Alexander Scriabin, developed a bold new language of his own, as audacious as it was fiercely expressive. This summer's first concert program follows the course of Russian music at the turn of the 20th century, from Romanticism towards the flame. The evening culminates with the Rite of Spring, Stravinsky's sea-parting masterpiece that forever changed Western music.
In 1897, a reportedly inebriated Alexander Glazunov conducted the premiere of Sergei Rachmaninoff's First Symphony. The performance was a disaster. The composer Cesar Cui called the 21-year-old Rachmaninoff's new work, quote, a program symphony on the seven plagues of Egypt. If there was a conservatory in hell, Mr. Rachmaninoff's symphony would no doubt thoroughly entertain all of hell's creatures. End quote. Three depressed, fallow years followed. Rachmaninoff's sister-in-law wrote that only visits to a hypnotist restored the composer to, quote, a cheerfulness of spirit, a desire to work, and confidence in his abilities. End quote. And he returned to composition with a vengeance, producing the second piano concerto, the cello sonata, the Opus 23 preludes, the spring cantata, 12 songs, Opus 21, and the suite number 2 in C minor for two pianos, Opus 17. Beyond overcoming demons, it was also during this period, and in these works, that Rachmaninoff found his compositional voice. The second piano concerto casts off the youthful angst and bombast of the beleaguered First Symphony, in favor of the ravishing harmonies and impassioned lyricism that would become Rachmaninoff's signature. These qualities likewise characterize the suite number 2. Like the concerto, the suite is poetically expressive and stylistically assured. It is cast in 4 movements, beginning with a bold introduction, orchestral in its conception. Thank you. dizzying passage work elevates the second movement waltz from elegance to ecstasy. The third movement romance is one of Rachmaninoff's loveliest creations. Long, generous, melodic lines rise from a texture conceived from the sonic opulence of two pianos. The suite concludes with a heady tarantella. As in his concerti, Rachmaninoff's ferocious skill as a pianist is audible in the suite. Its virtuosic bravado and majestic sound serve as much to glorify the instrument as to gratify the pianists. For its perfect matrimony of technical assurance and personal expression, the suite must be heard as one of Rachmaninoff's finest artistic achievements.
As someone who was born in Russia and growing up in Russia as a little kid, I was born into a musical family, and I went for a few years to the special music school of the St. Petersburg Conservatory. I have to tell you that the name of Tchaikovsky in the Russian culture is gigantic. There's no composer that comes close to him.
Cellist Dmitry Atapin.
His name is at the same level of respect and the same level of influence in a way as is the name of the great Russian poets and writers like Pushkin or Tolstoy or Dostoevsky. He is easily an equal in the Russian psyche to the great German composers Mozart, Beethoven, and Brahms. You could easily say Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms, Tchaikovsky in one sentence, and a Russian probably would not flinch. I think that Tchaikovsky's music has intrinsic appeal to the concept of Russian soul, so to say, because he is someone who appeals very directly to the emotional world. And as a Russian, I can say that Russians are very emotionally oriented in their psyche, in their way of being. And Tchaikovsky has this incredible way of trapping the ears of a listener, trapping the soul of the listener with his gorgeous flowing melodies, incredible dramatic changes from happiness to sadness. And he has this kind of universal human appeal to the very basic aspects of human feelings. And so it makes it a very relatable music. And it, at the same time, that kind of goes straight to the center of what Russians appreciate about it.
Tchaikovsky composed his Serenade for Strings in C major, opus 48, in 1880. The work can be heard as an artistic credo of sorts. The private anguish Tchaikovsky wrestled with throughout his life has been well documented, centering primarily on his sexuality and social relationships. Add to these his cultural orientation as a less palpable but no less pointedly felt source of angst. Tchaikovsky was Russian and held a fervent love for his homeland. He likewise grew up with a deep affinity with French culture. His mother, with whom he was close, was an amateur pianist and singer of French descent. One anecdote relates how, as a child, Tchaikovsky would kiss Russia on a map of Europe, then spit on the rest of the continent, but with his hand covering France. The Russian-Western dichotomy would become more pronounced in his artistic maturity. Among the Russian composers of his generation, Tchaikovsky was the most firmly rooted in the Western classical tradition, and was thus aesthetically distanced from his self-trained compatriots known as the Five, or the Mighty Handful, Balakirev, Borodin, Kui, Mussorgsky, and Rimsky-Korsakov. These composers strive to create a distinctly Russian school of music. In other words, Tchaikovsky was not as Russian as the Russians, but nor did he quite fit among the German Romantics.
I think the concrete difference between someone like Rimsky-Korsakov or any member of the so-called Mighty Five and Tchaikovsky is that Rimsky-Korsakov chose to explore and to create a distinctly Russian sound in a way using Russian folk elements, not basing his music on Western European canon as much as someone like Tchaikovsky would. Actually, Tchaikovsky wrote symphonies. He wrote works that were influenced by his Western contemporaries. In fact, he mentions that some of his favorite composers, contemporary composers, were, for example, people like Saint-Saëns. You know, he was very much influenced by Mozart. Mozart was someone who he looked up to and actually decided to become a composer after listening to Don Giovanni. Rimsky-Korsakov, on the other hand, is someone who is attempting to create a distinctly Russian sound, somebody who goes into folk melodies of Russia using the so-called, at the time, Orientalisms in his music, so the augmented second and exploring Oriental motifs. You can think of, for example, Scheherazade is not really a symphony. It doesn't have this kind of a Germanic form to it, and it's trying to convey this exoticism of faraway lands, of a fairy tale. Tchaikovsky does not attempt to do that. Tchaikovsky writes a much more traditional music. He writes symphonies, as I mentioned before. He writes tone poems for orchestra based on Western canon, for example, Romeo and Juliet. So it is very difficult to pinpoint what makes Tchaikovsky's music Russian. And in fact, many of his contemporaries accused him of being a less than Russian composer, somebody who is very much a traditionalist and lives in Germany land, so to say.
In the Serenade for Strings, Tchaikovsky seems to work out his cultural identity before our very ears. The work demonstrates Western technique styled after Mozart, Tchaikovsky's musical idol. Musicologist Roland John Wiley calls the Serenade, quote, as closely knit a motivic work as Tchaikovsky ever wrote, end quote. The first movement, which Tchaikovsky labels Pezzo in forma di sonatina, is an overt homage to Mozart in both form and character. The descending melodic figure that begins the opening theme. Unifies much of the work, and the ascending scales that follow become the theme of the fetching second movement waltz. Those ascending scales also reappear in the introductory measures of the poignant third movement elegy. The serenade's rollicking finale is based on what Tchaikovsky identifies as a tema russo, yet derives from the motif that opens the Mozartian Pezzo in forma di sonatina. Lest there be any doubt, the Russian theme slows to a verbatim reprise of the previous melody before the serenade's climactic end. Wiley interprets the serenade as, quote, an essay in Western Russian rapprochement which favors Russia at the end, end quote. It is also, more importantly, a sheer triumphant work. Tchaikovsky's catharsis is our gain.
Alexander Scriabin is a very interesting figure in music history and in the piano literature.
Pianist Alessio Bax.
He was a very good pianist, to put it mildly. He wrote some very difficult music for piano that he could play, as has been recorded. But his style varied a lot from early on through his middle life and late. One thinks of three periods of Beethoven, but if you think of how different early Scriabin sounds from late Scriabin, it's quite stunning. Not to say that elements of late Scriabin were not present. I think very often we compare early Scriabin with the music of Chopin, but at the same time, it does not sound like Chopin. It's very Russian and very personal, very different than other Russian composers.
Concert Program 1 brings together three works from Scriabin's sizable output of music for piano. Two preludes, of which he composed over 100 in his career, and Vers la Flamme, a short work that was to be the beginning of his 11th piano sonata, but instead appeared as a poem for solo piano.
In the opus 16, number 1, you have almost like polyrhythms in the left hand, counter melody.
Pianist Lucille Chung.
And you have this beautiful tune in the right hand, almost like you don't hear a bar line. And I just love the way it flows. And as I said, it's very touching music. And it goes directly to the heart.
The Andante in B-flat major, opus 11, number 21, from a set of 24 preludes composed contemporaneously with Scriabin's opus 16, demonstrates a similar gentleness.
Then you have, in contrast, the opus 11, opus 16, as Alessio mentioned, very Chopinesque, but they're not really Chopinesque. They do have their own voices. I think the music is much more direct a bit simpler in the writing, especially the Opus 11, number 21, almost nocturne-like, but a little more direct, a little more touching. And there are only a few lines to this prelude, but I think it says so much more within these lines. The last piece I'll be playing is Vers la Flamme, which is Opus 72, one of his last works. It was composed in 1914. It literally means towards the flame. He gave the title Vers la Flamme because he thought the world would end and it was going towards the flames and it would erupt. And really the beginning, there's not really much of a melody. You have these semitones and it kind of ruminates, doesn't really move. You feel like time has suspended in a way. Then you have these 5 against 9 rubatos. At the end, it becomes really ecstatic with all of these tremolos. It really ends on a dramatic note. It's like the last note of the keyboard.
The program concludes with one of the landmark works of the 20th century literature, Igor Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring.
When Parisian audiences criticized the 1909 Ballet Russe season for lacking musical interest, the company's founding impresario, Sergei Diaghilev, responded with a series of new commissions. The first of these, Igor Stravinsky's The Firebird, premiered on June 25, 1910, at the Paris Opera. The Nouvelle Revue Française declared the Firebird, quote, the most exquisite marvel of equilibrium we have ever imagined between sounds, movements, and forms, end quote. The work made the 28-year-old Stravinsky, theretofore unknown to Western audiences, into an overnight sensation. 3 months later, Stravinsky began discussing a scenario for a new ballet on a prehistoric subject with the painter and designer Nikolai Rorich, which would be realized as The Rite of Spring, arguably the single most notorious work of the 20th century. The ballet scenario centers on a sacrificial pagan fertility rite. As Stravinsky wrote years later, quote, I saw in my imagination a solemn pagan rite. Sage elders, seated in a circle, watched a young girl dance herself to death. They were sacrificing her to propitiate the god of spring, end quote. The Rite of Spring received its historic premiere on May 29, 1913, at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées in Paris. Choreographed by Vaslav Nijinsky, who 1 year before had premiered a ballet for Diaghilev on Debussy's Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun, the premiere met with legendary scandal. The bold dissonances and rhythmic patterns of Stravinsky's score, combined with Nijinsky's shockingly erotic choreography, led to agitated jeers from the audience and vociferous arguments in the house between those who supported the work and those who opposed it. The composer's own four-hand piano arrangement of The Rite of Spring represents the work's original manifestation. Stravinsky habitually worked out his musical ideas at the keyboard. Musicologist and pianist Peter Hill has surmised, quote, "The piano seems to have exerted an unseen influence on the Rite, far more than just a useful composing tool. The music has strong pianistic qualities. The snug fit under the pianist's hands of its harmonies suggests that many were discovered while improvising. Heard in concert, the four-hand version makes a distinctive and valid alternative. Paired to essentials, the music's rhythmic and harmonic dissonance have an even sharper focus." End quote. The Rite of Spring unfolds in a series of episodes over two parts. Part 1, Adoration of the Earth, begins with a solo melody, set in the orchestral version in the bassoon. At the time of the Rite of Spring's premiere, the bassoon, still often regarded today as the clown of the orchestra for its nasal, sometimes cartoonish, double reed timbre, had rarely been entrusted with a melody of such lyricism and dramatic import. Stravinsky, moreover, set the melody in the bassoon's seldom used high register, eliciting laughter from cynical listeners at the premiere. History has vindicated Stravinsky. This opening melody has become one of the 20th century literature's signature moments. In the four-hand piano arrangement, even without the bassoon's curious timbre, these opening measures set a mysterious tone. The introduction proceeds to traverse increasingly thorny textures until the opening melody returns. A staccato march-like figure signals the end of the introduction, and heavy-handed bass chords announce the next episode, The Augurs of Spring, Dances of the Young Girls. Stravinsky sets the dance to strange rhythmic patterns and irregular accents. The dance accelerates into the frantic third episode, Ritual of Abductions. The agitated melody yields to a gentle trill, and a new pastoral melody heralds the next episode, Spring Rounds. Following this innocent new melody, however, comes a series of stoic, primordial chords, as if emerging from beneath the surface of the earth. The music escalates into loud, crashing dissonances, culminating in a volcanic burst of energy. Next comes the wild Ritual of the Two Rival Tribes. Through the increasingly frenzied ritual emerges the melody of the next episode, Procession of the Oldest and the Wisest One. After a sudden pause comes a brief interlude, The Kiss of the Earth. The music immediately returns to a frenetic tempo for the final episode of Part 1, The Dancing Out of the Earth. Part 2, The Sacrifice, begins with an eerie, menacing introduction. The introduction ends with rumbling, subterranean chords that recall the earlier spring rounds, a lyrical melody, harmonized by harsh dissonances and set over a staccato eighth note pattern, depicts the mystic circle of the young girls. Drawing closer to the crux of the ritual, the dance is interrupted for the naming and honoring of the chosen one. In preparation for the sacrifice, the following episode depicts the evocation of the ancestral spirits. Quiet eighth notes and ominous chromatic figures set the scene for the ritual action of the ancestral spirits. A simple melody emerges as the ritual begins. Tension builds, and the music grows increasingly dense around the insistent melody before returning to the episode's opening music. The ballet culminates in the sacrificial dance. Marked by its impossibly difficult rhythms, this final episode represents perhaps the entire work's most dramatic departure from traditional concepts of ballet, and has become one of the most notorious passages of 20th century music. The music doesn't let up, challenging the performers with its intimidating rhythms and severe dissonances until the final measure. Audio Notes is authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Patrick Castillo, and Wu Han. Additional mastering is provided by Dahong Situ. Musical excerpts on this disc appear courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Rachmaninoff's Suite No. 2, performed by Martha Argerich and Nelson Friere, and Mahler's Piano Quartet, performed by Daniel Hope, Paul Neubauer, David Finkel, and Wu Han, appear courtesy of Deutsche Grammophon. Tchaikovsky's Serenade for Strings, performed by Choliang Lin, Ida Kavafian, Arno Sussman, Aaron Boyd, Areta Jula, Yura Lee, Kristen Lee, Sean Lee, Nicholas Dautricor, Richard O'Neill, Xinyun Huang, Steven Tenenbaum, Pierre Lapointe, Dane Johansson, Nicholas Kanalakis, Mihai Marika, and Kurt Marocki. Shostakovich's Piano Trio No. 1, performed by Ida Kavafian, Nicholas Alstedt, and Anne-Marie McDermott. Dohnányi's Piano Quintet No. 2, performed by Anne-Marie McDermott and the Orion String Quartet. And Dorensky's Piano Trio No. 1, performed by Oskar Shumsky, Leslie Parnas, and Emmanuel Axe, appear courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Scriabin's Preludes and Vers la Flamme are performed by Lucille Chung and appear courtesy of the artist. Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring is performed by Gilbert Kalish and Wu Han and appears courtesy of Music at Menlo Live. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Artist Led.